Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, Your Book listeners. I really hope you're enjoying these archive treats as much as I am, and that you're discovering some new books through some of our old friends. And on the theme of new books from old friends, I'd like to tell you about a brand new book from your old friend me. My new novel, Pity Party, is coming this summer. It's the story of Catherine, a woman who lives by the rules, ticks all the boxes, and prepares for the worst, even while she hopes for the best. Then the worst actually happens, and as she tries to navigate life as a young widow, it turns out she was not prepared at all. Pity Party is a romantic comedy about grief. It's a satire about trying to be a good person in the 21st century, and it's a love story with a twist. Its fans include Marion Keyes, Nina Stibbe and Katherine Heine. And hopefully you. Pity Party is out on the 11th of July and I'd love to invite friends of the Your Book podcast to pre-order from wherever you get your books. I know quite a few of you have pre-ordered already and I am so, so grateful. It really is the best way to support an author and it's an incredibly helpful way to show bookshops and publishers that you're excited about reading the book. You can pre-order from absolutely anywhere, including Amazon, Waterstones and bookshop.org. If you pre-order directly from your local independent bookshop, I will arrange a signed, personalised, dedicated bookplate for you. And if you order directly from my local bookshop, the Margate Bookshop, we can send your personalised copy straight to you. They deliver across the UK. There's a link to order Pity Party in the show notes. If you go to my newsletter, creativeconfidenceclinic.substack.com, you can have an exclusive look at the very first chapter. Lauren Bravo says, Pity Party is the funniest book you'll read this year. I hope it makes you laugh. Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. Now I know I'm very shy and I don't mention this often at all. My first novel, Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls, is out this week. Thank you all so, so much. You're all in the acknowledgements. I said it there and I'll say it here. There are no writers without readers like you, listeners. I really feel as though we've all been in this together, so I wanted you to be the very first people to meet Violet. Listen out for a little sneak preview, especially for you in the middle of the podcast. Now, today, I'm absolutely delighted to be able to bring you a conversation with my favourite author, Marion Keyes. Keyes has millions of fans, and I know that every single one of us has felt, while reading her, as though she is speaking directly to us and us alone. Her writing is beautiful, warm and wise, but she has a magical way of taking the profane and making it sacred. Her novel, Rachel's Holiday, is the book I've turned to the most often on dark days. I think it probably saved my life. I make no apologies for gushing. Fellow fans, I hope I've done you and her justice. Also, prepare for a stonking book list. 2020 has been an interesting year. Do you feel like your reading habits have changed at all? Have you reached for a different kind of book or had a different reading routine?
Yes, my relationship with books has changed in that, like, my concentration isn't what it would normally be. And things I've noticed, I find it much, much harder to read on a Kindle. I can almost not do it these days, and I get bored a lot faster, and it's just it I'm finding it both harder to disappear into books, and also I am far more needy for books. And I think it's because, I mean, I'm sure lots of people have heard that our ability to imagine has been impacted by the huge fear that we're all feeling. You know, whenever human beings are frightened, we have to shut down the dreaming part of ourselves, because we need to kind of focus all our energy on keeping ourselves safe. You know, we're sort of scanning the horizon for predators. And people who write have said it's much, much harder to write, or it has been this year. And also that people have talked about how their dreams are incredibly vivid. And that's because, like, we're not daydreaming. You know, we're not letting ourselves escape during the daytime. So we're doing it instead at nighttime. And it's the same with books. Like, I am desperate to shut down the anxiety, but also that ability to access the part of me where, you know, I'm away from the real world. It's much, much harder to get there. So yeah, it's been a tricky year with regards to reading.
And so what has helped? Are there any books that have delivered you from the outside world into a daydreaming space?
Yeah, some. Nearly 2 years ago, my dad died. And one of the things that happened kind of very quickly afterwards was I started reading Mills and Boons. And I used to read them when I, like, 1,000,000,000 years ago, when I was studying law. Like, every Saturday I used to go to bed and I used to read 3 Mills and Boons that my mother had got from the library. And, like, I mean, I read them and I was, like, kind of extravagantly scornful about them. Like, I mean, I spent so much of my time just making fun of them. But now I wanted the escape of them. And since I used to read them back then and now, they've started having sex, which is fabulous. You know, so there's all this kind of delicious, I mean, I wouldn't say it's un-PC sex. I mean, there's no kind of roughness or anything like that. But it's just, it is pure escape. And, like, I love the formulaic quality of it all. Like, you know, I start it off and I know he's going to be horrible and he's going to misunderstand her, and he you know, he doesn't realise what a lovely person she is. And the next thing, they're riding rings around each other. And it's just, it's a really, 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 really lovely safe space. And also this year I discovered Eva Ibbotson, which,
yes.
Oh my God almighty, I can't believe that I managed without her. I mean, she is perfect for me. I mean, she is my ideal kind of writer. She just creates such a beautiful world where, like, people are nice, but nobody is sappy. You know, and it's a very difficult act to pull off, to make likable characters that aren't irritating or boring. So that has been one of the nicest things that have happened this year in terms of reading. And I'm eking them out. But actually, I almost never reread books. And I have already reread The Secret Countess.
The Secret Countess, that's the only one I've read. But that was my gateway drug. And it's just,
yes,
the consistency of the universe.
Yes. Yes. The fact that there's this book written where, like, almost everyone in it is kind, and it doesn't become irritating or too sweet. It's a miracle thing. I mean, and, like, I'd love to know more about her. Like, the first of her books wasn't published until 1993, and she was born sometime in the 30s. You know, what a life she had, and was she writing during all that time? Like, I'd love to know more about her.
Oh, me too. Because I only know that she was, you know, in the war, and that,
yeah,
you know, is very present in her stories. But, I mean, that's such a skill as well in The Secret Countess, that looming threat. She's never afraid to address it, but also it's managed in a very kind of sane way. And that feels really right for now, I think, that we're all,
yeah,
scared, and she's not afraid to look the fear in the face and call it what it is. But also, she said, look, there is joy and love and kindness and diamonds everywhere. And I think the ball in The Secret Countess, it's so contrived in terms of how she is found out, but so delicious and so perfect. And it's just like a very, a very pleasing slotting in of things.
Yes. I mean, you're right in that, like, a lot of the plot points are contrived. And, like, we never doubted that there would be a happy ending. Like, of course there was going to be. But yet I didn't feel bored or offended. You know, I didn't feel like my intelligence was being insulted. Like, she created a contract with her readers. You know, we knew what she was giving us. And we were fully on board with it. And it was just beyond lovely. And anyone, I mean, I have given that book to kind of everyone I'm related to, like most people I've ever met. And everyone has loved it. And we've all gone, how did we not know until now?
In your own novels, do you feel an obligation to surprise?
I don't do unhappy endings, and I won't. And I feel apologetic for that in a way, because I feel like it very much limits me as a writer. And at the same time, I like what I write. And, you know, there was a really nice review of my most recent book, Grown Ups, in the Irish Times this year. And it said that thing that I said about Eva Ibbotson, that I have an invisible contract with my readers. And basically that you know what you're getting when you start reading one of mine. And it's not just the happy ending. I mean, there are various other tropes that crop up as well. Like, she did say riding men's, which I thought was funny. but yeah, the idea of a happy ending, or, you know, people being with the person they're meant to be with. I think I'm always going to do that. I would just find it really painful to not do it. I mean, obviously, I'm a complete romantic and a total sap. And as I say, I have these limitations. Because in real life, I think I would like everybody to be, everyone who wants to be coupled up should be coupled up. And I feel very kind of edgy in a world where that hasn't actually happened. You know, it's obviously something that was programmed in me very, very young, and I can't get rid of it. And it's part of me. And as I say, it limits me. But it also means that whoever reads me will know that, well, actually, people aren't going to be alone at the end of the book. I like at this stage that people know it's what I do, because then it means people can't be cross and say, oh, for God's sake, must they always end up with the blah blah? And I would go, yes, they must always end up with the blah blah. That is what I do, that is who I am, you know, and I'm sorry if it's offended you, and maybe you should read somebody else, and I say that with love, you know. But yeah, it is kind of a relief to know that that's what I can do.
Absolutely. As a comfort read, I just reread The Break, and I think that what it is about that book that I love so much is the home that Amy has created. And it's like the duvet cover that she makes for Sophie, and it's so fragmented but so beautiful and such a unit. And even without Hugh, and it's so devastating that Hugh isn't there, it's a space that you want to spend time in. And even the office and Hatch and the mad busts there, I think they're great. But, you know, that final scene, and, you know, to no spoilers, to have that ending that is genuinely joyous and hopeful and feels as much like a new beginning as an ending and is truly uplifting, but it's, you know, really emotionally intelligent and complex.
Thank you, Daisy. Thank you so much. I mean, The Break was a realistic depiction of a marriage, in that, like, marriages are not all skippiness and, you know, and rabbits and flowers. Like, marriages are relationships like any other relationship, in that, you know, there can be long spells of boringness or irritation or disconnection. You know, I wanted to be realistic about what a marriage actually is. And thank you for saying that. And, you know, I have always felt that I had completely the wrong idea about what marriage was supposed to be, you know, when I was in my 20s. I just thought a marriage would fix me. And, you know, I've learnt that nothing fixes me, and especially not a relationship with another person, that in many ways it you know, that can trigger my flaws, or, you know, give me insights into the worst parts of myself. So in writing The Break about two people who are connected and they do want to be together, but they also want other things. You know, I think when people do decide to come back together or to stay together, that is worthy of celebration. You know, and I will also say that if people decide not to, you know, that is their truth. And, you know, so long as a person is working and living from their truth, that's what's important. But I do love the idea of people saying, I've tried other things, you know, I've been out there and bits of it were nice. And there are parts of you that I really find difficult. But overall, I want to keep trying with you. I like the idea that people don't just give up immediately, you know, and I never thought I would be that person, but I've turned into my mother, you know, who used to say, people give up too easily. You know, people get divorced and they meet somebody else. And I do think, you know, the beginning of a relationship, when like you're insane, you know, when you're in love and you can't eat and like you're skipping around and like everything is joyous and delicious, like that feeling is incredibly attractive, and I, you know, when that wears off, people think, oh, it's the other person's fault, you know, I thought they were perfect and I thought they were the one. Instead, they should just think, oh, I see, that was the start of relationship, you know, narcotics, and now it's time to adjust to real life. But instead, lots of people go off and they look for the narcotic effect with other people, and you never get to that place where like where you're two human beings being honest and kind of working in companionable tandem to make a good life. And like for me now, that's what I get from being married and being in a relationship for a long time. It's that lovely thing. If he's seen me at my best, he's seen me at my worst, I can be who I really am. I don't have to pretend, and he's not going to leg it. Like, I value that so much. Whereas back in the day, it was the narcotic, instant, early day stuff that I loved. So yeah, I'm going a long way around saying that I think writing about long-term relationships is something that, if it's done well, can be uplifting and very romantic and very loving.
Oh, I feel quite overwhelmed in a really lovely way. I know we've talked about Mills and Boone. What were the love stories that you remember first encountering and being really drawn to or struck by?
You see, I had a very weird upbringing in terms of books. Like, I discovered Enid Blyton's when I was about six, and I fell in love. I mean, I've often said, like, reading was my first addiction. Like, it was my first wonderful way to escape reality. But my parents weren't booky types. And like, maybe it was just the house I was brought up in, but there weren't books. But then when I was about 12, my dad joined, I think it was the Reader's Digest book club. So like all these kind of disparate books used to come into the house and I'd read them all. And I think maybe the first love story that I remember was Gone with the Wind. I mean, I loved it all. Like, it wasn't just the love story, it was her. I loved Scarlett O'Hara and her, you know, her brutal sense of self-preservation. But then I was reading other things, like In Cold Blood came the following month, you know, and Catch 22 the following month. So like, I was reading all these books and I had no ability to decide what was good and what wasn't, or what I liked and what I didn't. Then I became a teenager, and then we were all into that kind of horrendously pretentious reading George Orwell and James Joyce. And I tried reading, what's his name, Tolstoy, because I thought it sounded impressive. And it was agony trying to get into it. And I didn't understand for a long time that like reading is meant to be about pleasure, the way it had been when I was a child. So apart from the Mills and Boons, the first things that really, really made me happy were, you know, the Jilly Cooper books,
yes.
The Octavia and Millie, and oh my God, I loved them so much, because like, they had the same, I suppose, structure as a Mills and Boone, but they were modern. You know, they were about women, like, well, they were older than me, but they were women that I could identify with. And it's funny, like, we did a Jane Austen book at school, I think it was Persuasion, and it killed any potential love for me for Jane Austen. Like, it's awful. I am the only person in the world who doesn't love Jane Austen. And I know that people will be going, but like, school just killed it.
Persuasion is the wrong one. If you know, the first one you read. It doesn't, yeah. It's not going to land when you're a teenager in the 90s or
the 80s. No, it was the 70s, Daisy. That's how old I am. I left school in 1980. Jesus Christ.
That was when those amazing, the Dilly romances.
I mean, they were so funny.
Did you read the Rutger Chronicles, the Bonk Busters?
Oh my God, completely. Oh, I loved them so much. I had a good run of them. What was it? Riders, Rivals, The Man Who Made Husbands Jealous. Oh, what were the other ones? Oh,
Polo came in there somewhere.
Polo! Yes, 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 yes. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. And, like, around then, like, I used to read all of those kind of, you know, Lace yes. and, you know, Judith Krantz books. Oh, my God, they were wonderful. Like, they were absolutely bloody fantastic. And it's funny now. Lately, I have been craving something similar, but contemporary. You know, I want books about glamour. And rich people and fabulous clothes and, you know, private planes and private chefs. I suppose maybe because life has been so unglamorous lately and I suppose also incredibly grim and frightening, you know, with both the pandemic and I mean, I know Trump has gone hooray and everything, but like the world has been like that, you know, when the matches go out for the little match girl, that's how it's felt for a long time.
Oh God, Marion, that's bleak and so accurate.
Oh yeah. And I just want sparkle and I want people saying, let's go to Marrakesh right now and like going out and chartering a plane. Like I want all of that. I want platform shoes and I want drug taking and I want fabulous, you know, frocks and I want like, and I want to read about it. I want people like having sex with loads of people. And I, you know, I would love a Judith Krantz, but now, if anyone wants to write it, I will oh, buy it.
That would be just the greatest.
Would be great.
Because I long for a good book party and I'm much better at book parties where I can pretend I'm there than the real life sort. But,
oh yeah.
Just, you know, where the sort of the champagne never runs out and there's gossip and scandal and, I feel yes. like Charlize Theron could be there in a big gold frock.
Yes, and nobody behaves badly and people behave badly, but in an elegant, charming way and everybody is in on it, so nobody minds. Yeah, that would be great.
A writer called Fiona Walker, who is my Dilly Methodist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And yeah. her early books is that I just want to, it's like me reading like fantasy or sci-fi, but my sort of fantasy era is I just want to go and like live in 1998 and pretend I'm at a party in the Met Bar.
God, yes. It's funny, I've been thinking a lot about the 90s lately. They really were wonderful, weren't they? You know, there was no sense of impending doom, really. And there seemed to be nothing really to worry about in terms of politics. I mean, I'm probably entirely wrong, but compared to now, it just feels, oh my God, if I could travel back like 27 years, less even, you know, it would be just, people seemed to be able to enjoy themselves without consequences. That would be nice.
It'd be nice. And it's something that, something that comes up a lot on this podcast is I really love a good boozy book. And as, you know, I get older and my tolerance for any kind of drinking, you know, diminishes and I have two glasses of wine and then I can't do anything the next day. But I love, and Gilly does this so well and lots of writers do, but those like drunken lunches and everyone's like, oh, someone's at the door, have some whiskey, have a vodka and tonic.
Yes. I mean, wouldn't you love to be that person who arrived at the door and you think, well, I'm meant to go back to work this afternoon. But what the hell? Go on, pour us a drink. I'll make a call. It'll all be all right. Or even better, I won't make a call because people didn't have mobile phones then. So if you didn't come back, they couldn't get you. Like, yeah, it was just far more debauched and free.
I love how supportive you are of new books, new writers on Twitter. I've been the very, very lucky recipient of that.
Love your book. Oh, my God, I love it so much. Honest to God, it was so refreshing. You know, I mean, it was great fun and lots of things. And and you write so well. Honestly, I was so jealous. There were so many phrases and I just, you know, my heart would clench just with admiration, but also kind of a, you know, that awful shame when you see somebody else do something fabulous and you think, oh, if only I had worked harder, I might have been able to do that too. No, it was so nice, but it was so lovely to read about a young woman having shame-free sex.
Well, I didn't bring it up to get you to say
okay,
that.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you so much. I'm a blush. But other books that you have, new proofs, things that have come out recently or are coming out that you've discovered on the internet that have really stayed in your head?
Oh my God, Luster.
Yes.
Jesus Christ. I mean, it's amazing, but incredibly powerfully affecting. You know, it made me, not that I didn't know it anyway, but it made me realize how incredibly life, how hard life is for young women, and particularly young Black women. It's a kind of a deliciously angry, vicious, sad, powerful, affecting book. That really stayed with me. Now, I'm terribly excited because today the new proof for Catherine Heine's new book was announced on Twitter.
And
I saw you looking for it as well. I mean, Standard Deviation is just, it's one of those books like that creates this. Her tone is very wry. She's kind of like a less bitter Maria Semple. I mean, I find her lighter and more likable is an invidious word to use about women. But Standard Deviation, I went out and I bought her short stories afterwards because I loved it so much. So I'm really excited about the new novel. There's just such a kind of a knowingness in how she processes the world and gives it back to us. It's very funny, so funny about rich people in New York, or not even rich people, but people who are on that margin, who are kind of almost bankrupted, sending their kids to private school and doing their level best to kind of keep up with all the people living in the apartments around them. And it's just very, very funny. She's very good on relationships.
Did you read Fleischman Is in Trouble?
I did. Now, I thought it was absolutely amazing. But the first half of it, I didn't realise what was going on. I mean, I thought we were just listening to this whiny sub-Philip Roth bloke, you know, telling us about his terrible wife and then being really kind of Philip Roth-y about the sex he was having. But the second half of the book, then it all made sense. And I mean, it was so, I mean, it was such an angry book and such a feminist book.
Do you know a writer called Eleanor Lippman?
Oh my God. Yes, I love her books. I have two on the floor here beside me. Hang on, I'm going to switch my thing around and show you my to be read pile. I'm going to have to move me tights and me knickers. can you see it there?
I see Glennon Doyle and Elton John.
Hang on, but I think I have two Eleanor Lippmans here, unless I've moved them over to my other shelf. But yes, I do have two Eleanor Lippmans waiting to be read. Yes, I love her.
And I just discovered her this year, and I read Good Riddance and On Turpentine Lane? Or just Turpentine Lane? There's one where she's buying a house.
Yes. Yeah, they're so funny. There's a writer called Laurie Graham, who, to me... Yes, you've heard of her?
I found her books when I was a teenager, and I think my dad is a fan, and I just picked it up on the shelf, and it's called The 5 o'clock Horses, and there's quite a lot of sex in it, and the man was having an affair, and I was, you know, young enough to be like, hey, look what we've got here, but she's so funny.
Yeah, but those kind of voices are exactly, that is my favourite kind of book. You know, people who are comic, but also carrying pain and also carrying wisdom. That's what I like. Yeah, I like reading about relationships. I like reading about sex, and I like reading about money, especially at the moment, just because I'm craving the glamour.
Oh, me too. And I'm having another comfort read. I'm not really stretching myself. I like to read Rivals at Christmas.
That was the second one, wasn't it? Yeah. And it was very 80s. It was all about, yeah, you know, ball breaker ladies in high heels and stilettos and insisting on like 8 orgasms a go. And yeah, it was just fantastic. I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, I read the Glennon Doyle book last night simply because I was curious. I thought I would hate it, and I didn't. There is some genuine wisdom in there for sure. It's just I find it, the way Americans package their wisdom can be quite chilly, I think, for people on this side of the Atlantic. I find the gurus don't always be as warm as I would like. But actually, it was interesting and comforting at times. And actually, there was a bit that was really, really funny. She was writing about how she found out that her husband was cheating on her. And she was just about to start a book tour, which was about the book she had written where she'd, you know, embraced sobriety, she'd given up bulimia and she'd given up alcohol, and she had found, you know, a new fulfilling life in her marriage with her son, being sober. And she was so angry with her husband, not for sleeping with other people, but for fucking up her narrative, you know, because this was her shtick. You know, this was like, I have, you know, found happiness with this man and this child, and you know, I am not the woman that was out there drinking and being promiscuous. And it was just very, very, very funny, which was unexpected, and I liked her a lot because of it.
Do you know Anne Lamott?
Anne Lamott, oh my God, I love her.
I think she's great, and I think she's so funny.
She's hilarious. Bird by Bird is one of my most favourite books of my entire life. Yeah, I love her because I love her vulnerability. I love her wisdom. And yeah, and I love her humour. Like, anybody who can be wise and funny at the same time can have my money. Yeah, I love her. And I love her writing advice. Actually, Jesus, I must read Bird by Bird again. I haven't read it in a while. Yes, I love her. I've read a couple of her novels. I prefer her nonfiction. I prefer when she's just talking to me and telling me how to live my life, telling me what to do.
You don't want that sort of any story or anything getting in the way. And I've not read her novels, and I really want to, but I also have that sense of I just kind of want her. And I think Almost Everything is another book that I loved. And her, this year especially, looking for tiny, tiny affirming things and scraps of good in the bad and single and in someone else's hands, that could just be awful, but she makes it really beautiful and great.
Yeah, because she's not, I suppose, she's not twee, she's not preachy. Yeah, and like, she, it's coming from lived experience. You know, she has been there.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
We'll be back to Marion shortly. This week, instead of the steal of the week, I would like to share an audio clip for Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls, read by Charlie Clive.
I don't want to be at this party. Quite honestly, I suspect the party does not want me either. I am about 6 miles from my flat and 60 million miles outside my comfort zone. For every guest, there seems to be three waiters carrying pyramid-stacked platters of lobster rolls. No one is acknowledging the waiters, let alone saying, "No, thank you." This is not my world. This is very much my boss's natural habitat, but unusually, the invitation wasn't addressed to her. It's my job to open all the nobody's post. And the Susan Miller app had mentioned something about bravely seizing opportunities instead of expecting them to arrive, and being rewarded by courageously forging new connections with influential VIPs. Anyway, it wasn't as though Connie was there to ask. Something to do with it being simply impossible to remortgage when you're in the middle of a basement conversion. Which is her justification for coming into the office 4 times in 3 weeks. In order to get Connie to listen to anything, you have to ad-lib random bits of property and interiors information. For example, "Rich from Sotheby's rang, can you call him back? And then I'll tell you about the Jonathan Adler cushions I saw in TK Maxx on Kensington High Street." So here I am, bravely not talking to anyone, courageously staring at the ceiling, pretending to be fascinated by a disco ball that is shaped like a Rubik's Cube. I'm waiting for a reply from handsome Dan, 32, who is, according to his Bumble bio, not here for a good time, here for a long time. Semi-stealing the invite was a transparent attempt to impress him. I thought, "Do you fancy this gallery opening? There's a free bar." Sounded more appealing than, "Do you want to come and have sex with me in my shabby ex-council flat?" According to the internet, Dan works in publishing. Dan vaguely knows someone I was at university with, and Dan is capable of composing the kind of brief, concise, erudite filth that would leave me, against my better judgment, wanking at work, feet up against the cubicle door of the disabled loo, thumb on my clit, index finger working its way into the slipperiest part of myself until I'd come, shuddering and gasping silently. I've cried in that toilet. I've eaten supermarket sushi in that toilet. Now, thanks to Dan, I've achieved more satisfaction in that toilet than I've known in any other area of the workplace. My exciting new single life has not quite been the thrilling, giddy, zipless fuckfest I was hoping for. My best friend Nadia says that Tinder should change their advertising slogan to "The odds are good, but the goods are odd." Oh, ex-best friend, I guess. For half a second, I remember all over again and feel as though I've dropped my heart down a well. Still, I'm yet to meet someone who proves her wrong.
Insatiable is available on Audible, and signed copies of the book are available from Waterstones, Blackwells, Foyles, and the Seven Oaks Bookshop. You can also buy it from bookshop.org and Amazon. Now, back to Marion.
I've just had a thought. If you want sex and glamour and parties, do you know Eve Babbitts?
No.
Oh boy.
She is still with us, but in the 70s. So did you read Daisy Jones and the Six?
Yes, I did.
Well, she's sort of real life Daisy Jones.
Really?
To do a big clangy name drop, we had Taylor Jenkins Reid on the podcast who said, Daisy Jones would have hated Eve Babbitts. They wouldn't have got on. But she was that kind of proper, like, Laurel Canyon-y, but sort of a bit more, very louche. She writes that in her novels, she kind of just writes the same book over and over again, but it's such a
lovely
pleasure to read it.
Yes.
That's all you
sometimes
want.
Sometimes that's really nice, isn't it? Right, I'm looking here, I have Slow Days, Fast Company. That is a name.
It is.
That is brilliant. Sex and Rage, LA Woman, Black Swans, I Used to Be Charming. Yes, write them. Would you recommend a particular one for me to start?
Now, I think Eve's Hollywood, it's the first one that I read, and that's the most sort of the essence of her. One of the odd things I love about Eve that you're probably not supposed to love is she's just like the sexiest, glamorous, wittiest, coolest woman who ever was. But she's still a bit preoccupied with, like, you know, being fash and getting fash and how much the alcohol is playing a part in that, or whether or not she feels hot enough to go out or not.
Isn't it horrific? Isn't it just horrific what has been done to us? You know, we're given such an incredibly punishing template to fit ourselves inside. It's horrific that even somebody like her would feel it. It's awful. Now, will we talk about Barbara Chiappino?
Yes! Oh! It's so weird. We just today recorded an episode with Ella Risbridger, who is excellent.
Oh, and yes!
We started with her, the two writers she wanted to talk about the most were Eva Ibbotson and Barbara Trepido.
Go on. Oh my God, that's really weird. Now there's a coincidence. Yeah. I mean, I love those books so much. And it's so funny. I identify with nothing. They are the women in those books, the girls in those books are absolutely nothing like me. Like, I can't imagine being in my early 20s and wanting to go to classical music concerts. It is beyond me. And yet the books are so charming. And the way they think, their feelings, I suppose, are similar to mine, even though their worlds and their intellectual pursuits are so different. Yet they're absolutely gorgeous.
Which is the first that you read?
It was the one where the sister has died. Oh my God, it was the saddest thing.
Travelling Horn Player.
Yes, yeah. My little niece, who's 3 and a bit, who can't read or anything, went through my shelves the other day and went off with it. And I thought that was interesting, you know, because there's a lot of books over there. And that's the one she picked. She kind of homed in on Barbara Trepido, and the Travelling Horn Player was the one. Yeah, I found it so incredibly moving.
I think that a lot of her characters are sort of liberated. They get to be, you know, women in a straight world who can really shake things up.
Yeah, that they have a kind of an unusual confidence. For me, reading Barbara Trepido is like entering an entirely different world. And it's lovely. I mean, I'd recommend everyone read Brother the More Famous Jack and see if it takes. Because that's the lovely thing. If you read it and you like it, there are so many more afterwards.
I feel as though everyone who's read it must have a occasional fantasy about being adopted by the Goldmans, no matter how lovely your family are. My friend Lauren Bravo, the writer, said that what she loves so much about Brother of the More Famous Jack is it made having a grubby kitchen seem quite aspirational and cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that like a clean kitchen is just a kind of very bourgeois, narrow kind of way of thinking. Yeah. Have you read Fabulous Nobodies?
Yes. This is just a Mentionitis podcast, but I believe Sarah Manning gave that to me as a gift. Is that the one where they're trying to start up various club nights and things and they're in New York and they're just always getting dressed up?
Yeah, it's in New York, set in New York, I think in 1982. It's one of my most favourite books of all time. Yeah, it's about this young woman who's a door whore in one of these clubs in New York. And it's about fashion. It's about being young. It's about being young and having no money and living in this incredibly crappy apartment. And it's just very sweet, very lovable, very aspirational. Like I said earlier on, like I almost never reread books, but I've reread that several times. It just, in the way it makes me feel, it's just very happy and young and hopeful. And yeah, like she's got everything ahead of her and she isn't old enough to worry, I suppose, about things. It's lovely.
I'm trying to think because I can sort of imagine my copy and I'm like, where is it? I need to look for it. Did you read that when it came out or did you find it later?
No, it was around the time it came out, like it was sometime in the 80s. You see, for a long time, I would never spend money on books. Like anything I read was because somebody else gave it to me or, you know, I got it in the church sale or something like that. So it was all very hit and miss. I didn't start actually buying books from bookshops until probably around when I got published. So like my reading education has been so kind of scattergun. But I had a boss for a long time who had really good taste. Like, you know, she used to give me Nora Ephron and Barbara Vine. You know, could you imagine having a life without Barbara Vine? Did you love her? I'm not picking up loving signals from you.
No, I'm trying to. I feel like I maybe tried the wrong book when I was a little bit too young, maybe. And does she? She's not Ruth Rendell, is she?
She is.
She's Ruth Rendell, because that was it. Because I think it was one of those sort of my mum saying, you'll like this, and me being a sulky teen or preteen having a truck with it. But I must go back to Barbara Vine. Sell her to me. Not that she needs selling. That's insulting to Barbara Vine.
Oh, no, but like if you didn't like it, you didn't like it. Or if you're at the wrong age or if you're feeling defiant and wanted to show your mother that you were actually your own person. So that's fair enough. But they were just, they're kind of weird because it's like they're almost out of time. You know, they are very much not anchored in the real world. And often people are living in houses away from other people, you know, like there'd be a load of young people living there. And it's not entirely realistic, except the way people relate to each other. There's always a kind of a dreamy atmosphere. And there are twists that, honest to God, you never, ever saw coming. I would recommend her so highly. And I tried reading Ruth Rendell books as well, but they didn't take with me at all. Whereas the Barbara Vine ones completely did. If you've read the Tana French books, In the Woods and The Likeness, they have that same feel for me as Barbara Vine. I love Tana French. I love Tana French's books.
That is so weird because Ella said that exact sentence a few hours ago.
Mother of Jesus, what's going on? There's a tear in the universe. And
the laptop's on a lane. But I love it. It's really, really lovely. It's very sort of, I must go and read these books now.
And can I recommend another wonderful, I suppose they call them crime writers, but like Jane Harper, she's an Australian writer. She wrote The Dry and she's written four now. They are utter magnificence. You know, they should be winning prizes. Like they absolutely transcend genre, I think the way that Tana French does. I honestly think you'll love them because it's all about close relationships and, you know, friendships and friendships from like teenage years that kind of go sour or went sour. They're both such wonderful, wonderful writers. And Tana French's new book, The Searcher, it's just, I love it so enormously much. That's been one of my books of the year, ooh, I'd say.
I can't wait to get into this.
But it just goes to show that like people can have really similar tastes.
And then
you can both read a book and it can absolutely affect you in really divergent ways.
And I think that so much of it as well, but it's like Barbara Vine and just, you know, when you read something.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, absolutely. And I really feel unless a person feels that the author has been deliberately lazy or deliberately meretricious, that to criticise a book, it shouldn't really be done. I mean, I say this as a reader, not as a writer, because obviously, you know, books do get criticised. But I think it's always such a subjective experience, you know, the relationship between a book and a reader. It's unique. And because human beings are so incredibly complex and we don't even really know what we're responding with when we fall in love with the book or when we find it, you know, absolutely repellent. I think, you know, to say, I hated this book and, you know, to say it publicly, I just think just because say I didn't like a book, I would always like to say just because I didn't like it doesn't mean that it actually means anything, you know, in an objective way. Like it absolutely doesn't. I don't think there can be a kind of a widespread consensus that a book is rubbish.
I think it's a little bit like a holiday, isn't it? And there are infinite holidays and infinite ways to have that experience. And
yes,
you know,
yes.
You can be, you might hate museums, you might hate the water park, but someone out there will love them. If I've loved something, I want the writer to know. If I haven't, that is none of the writer's business.
Thank you. That is exactly how I think about it. You know, I agree with absolutely everything you've said. And like, there's enough meanness out there. Why add a little bit more into public discourse? And I think it's a very generous act, as you know, as you've outlined, to just not tell them, you know, just don't let a person know that the thing they created displeased you. I've just thought of another book that I really, really loved and that I've reread a couple of times. It's called The Madonnas of Leningrad. And it's by an American writer called Deborah Dean. And it's set during the siege of Leningrad in, I think it was the Hermitage Museum, and the people of Leningrad are starving, and the pictures in the museum have all been taken away for safety because they're afraid that the Nazis, when they arrive, will take them, steal them. And it's about two people, a young man and woman, and they fall in love, and there's almost nothing to eat, and there are no beautiful pictures to look at, but they stand in the art gallery, and they look at the places on the wall where the pictures were, and they talk about them as if they were really there. And it's just, honest to God, incredibly beautiful. And it's about how people survive in extremis, you know, and how you can still find beauty by remembering it, even when it's not there in front of you. And I'm making it sound worthy, and it's not worthy. It's just honestly beautiful. And that would be one of the books I'd recommend very much.
What a premise. And what a resonant idea for now, that we need to, you know, we can see this beauty and we can imagine the experience of it.
Yes. Yeah, that it doesn't actually have to be there at all. Can I tell you about another lovely book?
Please do.
Gravity is the Thing. It's by Jacqueline Moriarty, who is the sister of Leanne Moriarty. And I always feel I shouldn't say that because they're both wonderful writers. In fact, there's a third one also called Nicola Moriarty. Like, they're just great in different ways. But Gravity is the Thing is just this fabulously insane sort of a book. It's about a woman who is going for flying lessons, but like, they're not like flying a plane lessons. They are like, literally, she is learning to fly by herself. And it sounds nonsense and it sounds, you know, ridiculous, but it's also incredibly earthy. It's very grounded. There's an awful lot about her relationship with her ex-husband, her relationship with her son. It's honestly so very, very beautiful. It's one of those ones. There's about 10 books I have that are the special ones, you know, and that I have never stopped loving. And that is the latest addition to it. So I think if people liked the other things that we've talked about, like Fabulous Nobodies and Eleanor Lippman and Laurie Graham and all of the other lovely ones, that they might like this one as well.
That sounds beautiful. I love that as an idea. And I think that sometimes I get a bit grumpy about how far I might be required to suspend my disbelief, forgetting that sometimes in a writer who uses the imaginary to explore the real and the fantastic, that's a delight. A writer I've just discovered this year and I'm overwhelmed with love for is Laurie Colwyn.
What on my dear? I don't know it at all. Hold on.
But there's something about happy all the time. If I describe what happens, it just sounds like nothing. And it's set in New York. And
lovely.
I think maybe in the 70s or 80s. And there's a real feeling of kind of interiors. It's about two very good friends. They're third cousins, but their relationship is sort of like brothers. And there's something a little bit Wes Anderson-y about that relationship, but maybe without
melancholy. I love Wes Anderson.
Wes Anderson would make the most amazing film of Happy All the Time. I might write to him. Oh, God, imagine. And there's the big, big finish. There's nothing really big about it at all. And it just sort of ends with them all having a lovely meal in a restaurant. And I remember closing the book and just feeling bereft. Like I'd been mugged, like I'd lost some family. Like I want to live in the book. I don't want to live in the world.
I totally understand that feeling. Okay, I've just put it on my list here. Thank God I have a whole load of lovely things to buy now because of you. Did you read Lily King's book, Writers and Lovers?
Oh, no, I've not read that.
Oh, my God, you must. Immediately.
I will do it now.
It is gorgeous. It's set in 1993, I think, in some one of those Boston suburbs, you know, those kind of full of intellectually ones, maybe near Harvard or Yale. And it's lovely. She's an aspiring novelist and she has no money and she has two new boyfriends. And it is just so lovely and so funny and so hopeful and all the lovely things. And she has written other books. Another book called Euphoria won a prize. And so I bought it, but it is set in, I don't know, 1910 or something like that. And I just wanted to be in the Boston suburb in 1993, working in a restaurant, writing her novel. It's just one of those lovely books. I honestly think you'll love it.
Just the idea that, you know, it's the 90s and she's broke.
Yeah.
and she is trying to make it work among a sea of mad intellectuals. Like, that's everything I like. Everything.
Yes.
Oh, Marion, I'm having the loveliest, loveliest time. And I want to talk to you all night, but I'm mindful of you have things to do. Are there any books we haven't mentioned that you'd really like to talk about?
Have a look. Nisha Dolan's book, Exciting Times.
I'm desperate to read that.
Oh, it's so great. Honest to God, it is so funny. I mean, in one way, it is agonizing about being young and a woman and living in late stage capitalism. But she is so wry and so funny. I would really be surprised if you didn't love it. What else? Okay, The Weekend by Charlotte Wood. She's an Australian writer. The Weekend is about three women in their 70s. Their friend has died and they go to clean out her holiday home. It's set in Australia. And, you know, you might think, oh, I don't know, I don't want to be reading books about women in their 70s. No, no, you are wrong. You do want to be reading books about women in their 70s. It's so funny and wise and snipey and bickery and all the good things. It's just so incredibly convincing. It's an absolutely brilliant, brilliant book. Not entirely uplifting, but not uplifting either. Let me see. Girl, Woman, Other. I mean, if there's a person on earth who hasn't read it yet, then I am cross. And then for me, for escapism, Anne Cleves writes her Shetland books. They're just, it's like going on holiday to Shetland, but without the two flights and the long wait in Aberdeen. Like, I would really, really recommend them. Philippa Gregory is so funny. I met her at an award ceremony years ago, and we were both up for the same prize, and we didn't get on, put it that way. And I admire her so much. I love her books, and I love the way she didn't make any effort to flim-flam me, do you know? And I won, and she sort of pretty much did a slow hand clap. It was magnificent. She was magnificent. And I love her books. In fact, there's a new one. It was published, I think it was yesterday. So both myself and my mother love her books. Okay, this is a hard, I don't know if everyone will love this, but I loved it. It's called If I Hit Your Face, and it's by Frances Chu. And it's set in Korea. And it's about the young women there having bone surgery to try and make themselves look more Western. It's kind of like Sex and the City, but gruesome and in Korea. It's fascinating. And I loved it. But mightn't be, most of the books we've talked about today are actually very uplifting. It's not uplifting, but I couldn't put it down, which I am always so grateful for that when a book does that for me. You know, one of those books that says, repays effort. You know, when you read that, like in a review, you think, oh God, I don't know, maybe not for me. After the Silence by Louise O'Neill. Again, so much I loved about it, but it was also like going on holidays to an island in West Cork in the summer, in the Atlantic. It was just lovely.
That's just won a prize, I believe.
Yes, it did, it did, it did. It did in the Irish Book Awards on Wednesday night. Yeah, it won Crime Novel of the Year. But, I mean, and it is a crime novel, but it's quite gothic. Mm. I'll say one more and then I'll shut up. Fragile by Sarah Hillary. I just finished the proof this morning. And she writes mostly crime. And I suppose this is sort of a crime, but it's a standalone book, and it's quite gothic. And in many ways, it reminded me of Barbara Vine, you know, that dreamy feel, that kind of out of time feel. You know, one of the main characters in it is this fabulous house. She's a really wonderful writer. You know, she writes about love and falling out of love in, oh God, in very scalpel-y efficiency. It's great.
That sounds fantastic. Marion, it has been an utter, utter joy, and I knew it would be, and I was so excited about having this conversation with you, but honestly, it has just made my heart so it's as good as reading you or reading Eva Ibbotson, and that's the greatest compliment I can think of off the top of my head.
Thank you. And thank you for the recommendations you've given me as well. I'm so grateful for them. I'm off to order them now from a good local bookstore.
Huge thanks to Marion.
Grown Ups is now out in paperback. I think it's her most sophisticated and subtle novel yet. Threads are woven and broken, and there's a real sense of life at its most keenly painful and joyful. It's about love, addiction, control, and the way we all sometimes struggle to function. It's funny, warm and real, and I could not recommend it harder. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation. Your book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at WhyBooked, and if you've enjoyed this episode, it would make my day if you left us a 5-star review. It helps new listeners to find the podcast. Find a list of all the books mentioned by Marion on acast.com/booked. Finally, I leave you with this from Anthony Pohl. People think that because the novel's invented, it isn't true. Exactly the reverse is the case. Biography and memoir can never be wholly true, since they cannot include every conceivable circumstance of what happened. The novel can do that. See you next time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.